Welcome to the Automate and Grow podcast, brought to you by Cloud Advisory.
Okay, welcome to another episode of Automate and Grow. This is episode 14, and I'm here today with Johannes Waldstein, and I'm probably saying that completely wrong, but hopefully it's close.
Thank you.
Okay, I need to learn German. And I'm doing this episode of Automate and Grow from beautiful Fort Worth, Texas, where I am here for the next 2 days. So it's a road show all around. Johannes is the founder of a company called Fan AI, and we wanted to talk to him today because they're doing some really interesting stuff around audience metrics and loyalty that has to do with the e-gaming space. So this is kind of a new space to me. I understand kind of rudimentary, so I'm excited to be talking to you today, and I really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you. And it's eSports.
eSports, what did I say, e-gaming?
E-gaming, yeah. So eSports is the correct term for that.
Got it. And so for people that maybe are not familiar, and I'm sure a lot are, eSports is centered around video gaming and by the best video gamers in the world, right?
Correct. So eSports, so you have competitive gaming where people can just play each other online. eSports has the idea of a physical venue or the people physically being together. And you have NBA 2K, you have Madden, you have FIFA. So those are the eSports of a traditional sport. And then you have Overwatch League, League of Legends, Counter-Strike, Dota 2, Street Fighter 5. You have a bunch of other competitive video games that are played at arenas or played in front of a studio audience that have nothing to do with the traditional sport. And you have millions of people watching it. You have millions in prize pools for it. And it's one of the fastest growing sports there is right now.
Amazing. So we had kind of talked a little bit before, and I think you had said that there's like 35 million people that watch eSports right now.
Yes, so there are about 35 million people following Turner E-League on Twitter at the moment, for instance, across all of the different teams and players. And then the audiences vary from about 100,000 people watching to about 1.5 million people watching any particular game.
Wow.
So it's a large audience of people watching that. So that's equivalent to one of the finals games in an NBA if you look at the streaming numbers.
Right. It's become huge. And where do you think we are right now in that space in particular? And then we can talk a little bit about what Fan AI does in response to that, because I know you perform some really interesting function right now. But where do you think we are, like, in that curve? Like, is this mature? Is it really early? Like, what's the status of that in as far as a market goes?
In South Korea and in some Asian countries, it's a lot more mature. So that's been going on for 10, 15 years. In the U.S., it's really, really new. So it's been growing really, really fast the last 2 or 3 years. And this year is the first year that there's an Overwatch League. So they launched a league this year. The NBA 2K launches with 17 NBA teams this year. League of Legends refranchised all of their North American league this year. So those are all new. There was no Overwatch League last year. And the first few games, you had 400,000 people streaming and watching that online. And they had no place to watch that last year.
That's incredible.
And then
we had talked about, I guess, from a broadcast point of view, Twitch is basically the network that a lot of these sports are broadcast across. Maybe just for people that don't know, explain what Twitch is, and I'm sure that plays into what Fan AI does.
Yeah, so if you imagine Twitch is something like a live YouTube, you have almost 200 million people a month watching mostly gaming and esports on Twitch every month. It was bought for almost $1 billion by Amazon. And Twitch is paying a lot for content. So they paid $90 million for 2 years to stream Overwatch League and be the place where you can watch that.
Wow, that's incredible. And then, so the idea for Fan AI was really born, it sounds, out of the need or the perceived need that sponsors or advertisers want to know who's watching, right?
Exactly. So I've done analytics in professional sports, the Bundesliga and Premier League soccer, I'd worked for Dunnhumby, one of the biggest analytic companies in traditional retail, so looking at 800 million loyalty cards. And we know that brands and sponsors want really detailed purchase and behavioral demographics on who the customers are. And that just didn't exist for esports. So when a big sponsor is looking at it, they say, a million people are watching, but do they buy in my category? Are they long haul flying? Do they buy insurance, or are they just on Lyft and Uber? Who are these people and what do they spend? And so we built a platform where we can work with somebody like Turner Ely, who's our client, or work with Cloud9, one of the top US esports teams. We can get their first party data, so names, emails, addresses, and then we can enrich that with a variety of data. So understand from LinkedIn what the people earn and what their jobs are. We get purchase behavior data, so we understand how they spend in a variety of categories. And from the fan's perspective, that means they get experiences and brand offers that are a lot more relevant, and it's less spam. It's not coming to them in an ad. It's content that's co-created with their favorite player, with their favorite team. And that's a much better fan experience than getting spammed by something that's not relevant.
And then what happens with this data? Like, it's something that an advertiser would purchase, or is there an ad platform that allows them, almost like a Facebook ad platform is very good at targeting, I know. What side of that fence does it play?
So we work with the first-party data that the team or the league has. So we provide them a platform to understand and analyze that. The brand or the sponsor can log in and look at the demographics but not see who the individuals are, so they can't see what the name, address, other details are. And then if they want to target or advertise to those people, we help our client facilitate that, whether that's a Facebook custom audience, whether that's retargeting them, whether that's an email campaign, whether that's through owned assets. And then it goes through the various social channels to get to those people.
So then from an advertiser point of view, would any company be able to come and plug into your Fan AI platform to build those custom audiences? Or who typically uses this on the advertiser side?
So on the advertiser side, it's kind of two sides of it. One is the sponsorship side, who's trying to look at what are the demographics of this team or league, evaluating which of those they want to sponsor. Once they're sponsoring them, understanding the demographics and the behaviors of what's going on, seeing whether there's more social engagement, whether there's kind of more ROI and traction going on. And yeah, then going to their agency or whoever's doing the campaigns and ad tech for them, being able to build custom audiences, see how well they go, how well they perform, being able to optimize them, etc.
Amazing. And how long has Fan AI been around?
So we've been around since July 2016.
Oh, wow. That's like very new.
a year and a half ago, we've raised $4.5 million in funding from leading VCs like Courtside Ventures, which is Dan Gilbert, Cleveland Cavaliers, and WPP.
Oh, right.
China Rock, backed by Alibaba and people who really know about esports. Sterling VC, who are the Wilpons money, so they own the Mets. Graycroft, which is a big LA VC, so really top VCs in the space. We work with about a third of the teams in esports, in Overwatch League, League of Legends, Counter-Strike, all of the main games. So yeah, we've been growing very along with the industry, growing very well over the last year and a half.
Yeah, that's incredibly exciting. And then I think you had mentioned that you had founded it really not so much as a data scientist, but based upon your previous background you discussed in kind of the loyalty market. So
exactly. So having worked with the largest data scientist company, knowing we worked with 4,000 brands then, we worked with all the major agencies, and what we found is that data and insight is not enough. If you're not achieving business outcomes, if it's not making you money, then the algorithm doesn't matter, the insight doesn't matter. So taking that philosophy to a new sport is really exciting, because the outcomes that they can achieve are huge, and that whole audience is already a digital audience. So there are big advantages being in that, and focused on the business outcome rather than just on numbers or just on insight or just on the data is very important.
So I think that's really important to highlight. I kind of like bringing that up because I think, you know, we had talked about how there's almost like this fear in, you know, let's call it Western society in particular, where we've seen so much change over the last 10 years in technology. It's affected not only business, like dramatically now, we're seeing some crazy tipping point changes in certain sectors like retail, for example. And there's almost like still not everybody's comfortable maybe with the digital stuff, but now digital's turning autonomous and automated. And so, you know, there's that chasm, but it sounds like you're not like a data scientist or anything. You're like a business guy, right?
Right, and we of course have data scientists in our team, and my co-founder is a data scientist. So without AI and without machine learning, you can't do at scale what we're doing. So to be able to understand human behavior over tens of millions or hundreds of millions of people, you need artificial intelligence or advanced algorithms to do that. But we as a business think that that's not enough, that an algorithm has no sense of humor, has no sense of irony, doesn't value a person as a unique individual. So we have an ethnographer, an anthropologist on staff who studies human culture, who studies those ironies and those senses of humor. And so we really think that human empathy and treating the individual as something of value is really, really important, and that the algorithm is not enough to do that. So we have a platform plus people that are able to do that.
Well, that's really interesting because it's, you know, one of the things that we always talk about, one of the themes is how to focus on the customer again. And I think people get caught up in the technology or caught up in audiences, but not really understanding the specific person. So it's really interesting to hear you talk about empathy. It's really interesting to hear you talk about anthropology, because I think another one of our guests had said, you know, that effectively entrepreneurs, for example, or marketers are like really committed. They're doing like digital anthropology now.
Yeah. Which,
and they're just like observing customers in the wild and then trying to divert them.
Yeah, so we do both. So we look at the data across millions of people. We also have done more than 100 interviews with people in person. We send teams to a bunch of events to observe and meet with people and talk with people. And it's also trying to find what are the passion drivers? Why are people doing what they're doing? So we'll look at a behavior mathematically, but then trying to understand what are the human elements behind that.
So what do you think is like the next 10 years looks like for this space, and particularly for Fan AI? Like where do you guys have a plan to go, and what do you think it's going to look like in 2028?
Wow, long time.
So maybe 5 years earlier, 2023. But
we want to be the best at helping people understand their audiences. So anywhere where there are people that are very passionate about something, being able to take those names or emails, understand them socially, understand their purchase behavior, being able to predict what they're doing. First in esports, which we think is going to be one of the biggest markets in the world, and then more sports and entertainment and other passion places outside of that. Esports and gaming, virtual reality, augmented immersive reality, all of that is really growing exponentially, and it's going to touch all of us and everyone. Something that's counterbalancing that a little bit that we see is people's desire for real human interaction. So there's a particular modern loneliness where we are hyper-connected, we're all sitting on our phone. You go to a restaurant and you see couples sitting across from each other, both on their phone. You have two sets of devices in between that relationship and maybe a mood candle in the middle, if you have technology in the middle. So I think community and physical events and getting together and doing some of those things is going to be increasingly important. So esports both has an online community and a huge digital audience, but it's also a place to meet with other people of community. So you get huge numbers of people going to Twitch cons or going to these big tournaments where they fill a 40,000 person stadium. You have ESL, Intel Extreme Masters in Katowice in 2 weeks. You have 150,000 people going to experience that event. Of course, not everyone fits inside, but
sure.
Watching on huge outside. So I think immersive, digital, gaming competition that's virtual reality, but also real human experience and wanting to have community with people like ourselves. I think both of those are going to be really, really important trends.
We keep hearing this theme from certain entrepreneurs, and some of them are, you know, just in the form of how, you know, they're trying to address that problem that you described, which is that the digital chasm where people are almost too digitally connected but not personally connected. And there's been a few entrepreneurs on that have talked about how their business model is to try to, you know, go not reverse, but to reconnect that. So it sounds like a consistent theme. The other one is how people are disconnecting from some of these social platforms. So it's really interesting to hear you talk about how, you know, your role in that. The one thing I wanted to touch on was two things, actually. One was, what was your development process like? It sounds like you launched in 2016. Is that when you started developing, or did you have some kernel of a product before that? And how long did it take you to actually build a product to then come to market?
Yeah, so we built a very quick prototype and launched that right away. One of the best ways to build things is to build it with your customers and to be very agile with that. We chose Tableau as a front end, which is a third-party data visualization tool, which saved us several million in front end development. So we used that as the front end, and we spent the majority of the initial investment in building out the algorithms, the data, the data partnerships on the back end. And right now we're starting to build our own front end. So we're looking for Python developers. If any of you know Python developers,
you heard it here first. If you need a job,
job in Santa Monica, we're looking for them.
Okay, so it's in Santa Monica. Are you based in San Francisco or Santa Monica? I thought it was.
We're now based in Santa Monica. We founded in San Francisco and then realized that Santa Monica was the place to go.
Amazing. Yeah, and there's a lot of really exciting things happening out of Silicon Beach. So
you have to do.
So what advice would you give to an entrepreneur that maybe is not, you know, I hear this all the time where they're like, I'm not a techie or I'm not technical, but they're dealing with a world that is obviously, you know, the opportunities are in digital. What sort of advice would you give to someone in that circumstance that, you know, maybe has an idea or is shutting down their ideas even as an entrepreneur?
I mean, my strategy has always been to find the absolute smartest co-founders I possibly could. It's very hard to run a business all on your own. There's almost nobody that has all of the skills. So if you're a business person, ideally you partner with somebody who can either build the minimum product or manage other people to build that minimum product. And that's a really good partnership because one person's thinking about what problem am I solving? How am I commercializing this? What's the vision of this? How do I sell this? Or how do I growth hack this to a large number of consumers? But you're right. Now you need somebody who can also hands-on build it or manage that. And so I'm lucky to have been a product manager and know how to manage the build. So I was able to do that at the beginning. But as quickly as possible, I got people into the business that could build it themselves. And technical co-founders. And then conversely, if you're a technical co-founder, getting somebody who can help on the sales, the marketing, the fundraising, it's a lot of work to both build and try to fundraise or sell.
And then how are you actually going to market from a sales and marketing point of view? Like, who's your customer and how are you getting in touch with them?
So our whole first set of customers were esports teams, leagues, and platforms. So that's a B2B, a relatively small universe of companies. And our investors own teams. We now know almost all of our customers really well. Right now, we're going to start launching more PR, more marketing, because now we're also going to agencies and brands who are interested in buying the data and getting access to that insight. So now we need to do more PR and more marketing in order to get that side of the market.
So from some companies are like automating marketing, for example, to generate leads, and then they're trying to figure out the sales model. And I find a lot of companies are challenged by that because they think that they're going to always automate the sales model, which sometimes yes and sometimes no. And maybe some of that's born out of SaaS or apps where it's a simple product and maybe the customer's purchasing decision process is simple. So where are you guys at? Like, are you direct? Are you digital? Are you kind of a hybrid of the two? And how did you decide that?
It's much more on the direct side because our platform is relatively high value. So it gets up into the six figures for a lot of our clients per year. So it's a large expenditure for them. They're not just going to buy that digitally. And also, we need to make sure that they get really valuable business outcomes out of what they're doing. So it's not just a passive here, take a look at some data or some insight, but it's how is this going to help your existing sponsors or new sponsors, or how is it going to help you monetize that data? So ours is a much more direct relationship sale. We get a lot of referrals, so our clients are huge advocates for us. They introduce us to a lot of new sales, but it's much more on that direct relationship sale, long sales cycle side for us.
It's a funny trend because people that I talk to in this space, you would think that things like, you know, the perception might be that things like marketing automation would lead to sales automation. But I think in fact what's happening is almost like that human value of the relationship and those like business development type connections are actually growing, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
And that seems to be kind of what's happening in your business anyway.
It certainly is. And particularly that it's an entirely new industry means that having people who can help figure out what that is really, really helps them. If it's something that's a lot more established and it's more cookie cutter, then maybe that's less of an issue. But in something new, having people there to explain what the data is, having an ethnographer understand the cultures, these things are really, really valuable at the beginning of an industry.
Oh, that's really interesting. So I think you alluded to this, but does Fan AI have a play in traditional sports?
Yeah, so we already work with some traditional sports clients like Cleveland Cavaliers. We work with their NBA 2K team and their esports teams, but also with their traditional data or their traditional team. And yeah, we can enrich for sports and entertainment exactly the same way we can in esports. We chose esports because it's massively growing and has a big gap, but we're also starting to work in sports and entertainment.
And I don't know the scale of your platform, like as far as like the barriers to entry cost or, you know, complexity, but I work a little bit with hockey teams, for example, in one specific organization. And I think the big thing is they don't really know who their fan is. The way you're describing it with esports, that seems to me like that would be very valuable for even like a minor league or a junior hockey team or, you know, other sports like baseball, basketball. And I'm just curious like what the barriers to entry there are and if that's an opportunity that you're pursuing.
Not at the moment. We're trying to start with esports and with some of the big ones. They have more money, they have more data,
makes
brands
sense.
Are more interested in them. So we start there. And then when we are able to build a lighter version of our product that costs less, then an organization that doesn't have 100,000 of budget can upload their data, get a huge amount of insight from it. And that long tail is huge. But at the moment, we have 14 people in the company. We need to focus the top prospects first.
That makes sense. So, and then when you say data, where is that data coming from? Is it coming from CRM? Is it coming from point of sale? Like, there's probably some source of it. I'm kind of curious where that is.
Yeah, so all of our data is opted-in data. So we're not stealing this from any of the fans or from any of the customers. They've bought a piece of merchandise or a ticket, or they've opted into a mailing list. They've joined a giveaway. So there are a variety of places that the data comes from. We get that from our customer. They always own that data. If they cease the relationship with us, we give that back or we destroy that data. And then we're able to enrich that and help them activate against that data and make money from it, where at the moment they have a lot of data, but they don't know what to do with it.
Interesting. Okay, that's exciting. I'm very interested in what you're doing. I really applaud the success you've had in a very short amount of time. I'm guessing that this is just going to be, you know, 2 years from now I'm going to talk to you, and it's not going to be 14 people anymore. I'm thinking you guys are going to get quite big, quite fast. And I'm going to wrap up and be conscious of your time, by the way, on two questions. The one is that I ask most guests at the end is, how are you or how is Fan AI changing the world?
So I guess two things there. One is changing some of the misperceptions about esports. So a lot of people think about somebody down in a dark basement who's antisocial, who just plays video games, who has no life. So helping helping change that for the millions of people who are gamers and who are well-educated, are in great jobs, but who love playing video games or love watching video games. So trying to change the perception of that industry. And then trying to grow and monetize what at the moment is still just a billion-dollar sport, but is going to turn into a $20 billion sport over time. So really being able to turn that into something where people can have that as a full-time job. You have now hundreds of athletes who earn between $100,000 and $1 million a year playing professional video games. So Changing the lives of people who now have a new way to earn a living. And so understanding who the audience is, being able to monetize that, will give a whole industry a way for people to earn money.
So parents and teachers who are saying stop playing video games are probably wrong, it sounds like.
Depends. But in pro sports, it's a small number of people who are able to achieve that.
That makes sense. The top percentage are the stars, you're saying.
Right.
Yeah. And I'll wrap up on one final thing, and we kind of put our guests on the spot at the end. So when we have an interesting guest on, we would like you to introduce us to someone that you think should also appear on the Automate and Grow podcast. Someone that is, someone that you can introduce us to that would kind of fall in either entrepreneur or expert in some of the topics that we talked about. So I'd like to know who you would like to nominate to appear on the show.
Yeah, so I would love to nominate another tech person. It's called, the company's GumGum Sports, and they do algorithms in visual recognition. So being able to see in image, whether that's a stream or whether that's a photo, sponsorship experiences and other things, and they're doing some amazing things in this space. So I'd love to introduce you to somebody from there.
Terrific. Do we have someone specific you want to nominate, or?
Yes. Let me look up the Jeff Katz.
Jeff Katz. Okay, so Jeff. That name sounds really familiar. I don't know why. But Jeff, you've been nominated to appear on an episode of Automate and Grow, and we're going to follow up on that to try and get you to jump on with us. I want to thank you very much for your time. This has really been informational for me, and I think it's also inspiring how you're kind of in the early stages of this pioneering work in a growing industry that's probably didn't exist 15 years ago. So thank you very much. This has been another episode of Automate and Grow. Episode 14, and we'll look for everybody on episode 15.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
This has been an episode of the Automate and Grow podcast. Check out other episodes for interesting topics on how to grow, innovate, and automate your business. Subscribe or like us on iTunes, YouTube, Google Play, or on our website at www.automategrow.biz, and get your copy of the book Automate and Grow at Amazon today.